listening to Angoffa Arts, a podcast about reading
and writing
for people who love books.
This episode was recorded on Gadigal and Bidjigal lands of the Eora Nation.
Hello, book world, and welcome to the Angoffa Arts podcast. My name is Sarah Sasson. I'm a Sydney-based author, doctor, and researcher, and I'll be your host. Every week, we'll be chatting to local authors and other members of the literary community. So let's see who we'll be catching up with this week. Samuel Bernard is a literary agent at Zeitgeist Agency in Sydney and also an editor, book critic, and freelance writer. His columns include the top 10 books for the Weekend Australian. In 2024, Samuel was named an inaugural judge for the Australian Fiction Prize, and more recently, in 2026, he became a judge for the prestigious Dorothy Hewitt Award. Hello, and welcome to the podcast, Samuel Bernard.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's great to finally meet you as well, because I read your book and it was fantastic, and I included it in my notable books for the Weekend Australian, I believe, from memory.
You did. Thank you. It's a funny way. Yeah, it's a funny way to meet people for the first time in the national press. Yeah, totally. So it's a heart stop moment when you pick up the paper and you wonder what kind of day it's going to be, but. Thank you.
Well, so, I'm glad I was very kind as well, because that could have gone a different way for this podcast.
Yeah, otherwise you might not have been invited on the podcast.
That's right, exactly.
So how's your week going? Has it been filled with many book-related things, or has it been a less bookish time?
Oh, no, full on. Yeah, I've as an agent, I'm pitching and I'm negotiating. I've just actually had a meeting with our London and Brussels offices about books that are being requested by international publishers and all through Europe, and even some producers for some film and TV companies. And so, yes, all of that has been going on. I'm busy reading 10 books for my column in the Weekend Australian for January at the moment. So,
oh my goodness.
I am non-stop absolutely book. Deep in it. That's right. Yeah. You've got to love it to do this job. So I'm very lucky that I love to read, because I get paid to do it.
Yeah. So you work at Zeitgeist Agency. So you mentioned, so there's offices in Sydney, London, Brussels. How does that all work? So obviously you focus a little bit on the Australian, New Zealand market, but then you come together to sell into international.
Exactly. It's rare. Yeah, it's kind of what distinguishes us a little bit from other agencies in Australia, is that we've got these international offices, and so generally speaking, when I'm pitching to Australian publishers, I'm generally only offering ANZ rights, the Australian New Zealand rights. Of course, there's always exceptions to the rule, and it's all very strategic, but yeah, generally that's the way we go. And then that's when our London and Brussels teams step in and they try and take it to a global stage.
Because I'm obviously been in like a debut author crew with Tidelines. And yeah, I would say like the vast majority, if not all of us, got signed with Australian New Zealand rights. So I suspect it's quite unusual to get a big international signage on your debut book. But I guess what are you looking for? Like, what kind of books tend to cross over into that international market well? And also as a writer, it's an interesting conundrum, because, Australian readers do like to read about their own environment and social politics. But so it's interesting for me to think about what makes a book cross over to an international market.
Yeah, it's a great question, and we're always kind of thinking of those questions, because I don't think there's a silver bullet answer to it. Every single publisher, international and Australia, is looking for something specific to fill their void, to fill a gap, to fill a market that they're trying to do. So it is a tricky question. I've found universal stories are always, can always cross borders. Mm-hmm. Deeply Australian stories, like our history, for example, still has international interest, particularly in places like the UK. It's the nitty gritty of maybe specific sports, you know, AFL, for example, a sports book that, you know, that's never going to really take off internationally. But what we've found is international publishers are really just looking for good storytelling. It doesn't necessarily, I mean, it doesn't hurt, but it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, if we're trying to sell in the UK, it doesn't have to be a book that is partially set in the UK or have a English protagonist or something like that. As I said, it doesn't hurt, but it's certainly not required for it to be acquired internationally. They're really just looking for good stories, and it's about knowing those markets as well and trying to understand the readership that they're trying to target themselves.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, because I'm a big fan of Madeline Gray, the writer, and, you know, obviously Green Dot was huge and as I understand has sold internationally. And that's interesting because, you know, it's all about human relationship and, you know, it's very, very funny. But, yeah, I like the idea that, you know, those kinds of workplace relationships that get tense and go wrong, but you know that has an international appeal, and that there's people like her protagonist sitting over there in Europe or in North America, like having the same kind of issues that we do down here.
Absolutely, it's a universal language sometimes, yeah. Isn't it? But it's funny you mention her because I was on a phone call with a US agent who actually lives in Portugal, but I was having a chat to her the other day because often as agents we try and, you know, network and make sure that, you know, we've got these connections so we can use each other as co-agents for different territories and things like that. And she basically said, you know, the Green Dot, I loved it. If you have anything like that, I want it, you know. Oh, so it's interesting that you say that because it's hot property. She's hot property.
But then the other thing is, you know, as a reader with my reader hat on, like I recently read a beautiful Swedish book called The Trio, but part of what I look for as a reader is, you know, I love universal stories about human relationships, but it's also fun. It's a fun way to travel, right? Like I kind of like reading about specific cities and specific locations and how, you know, Midsummer is a really big deal in Scandinavia, you know, and I like getting that intricate detail, you know, without
Setting
foot on a plate. Yeah, so it's hard to get that balance between universality and specificness.
Sure. And, you know, Australia has that appeal internationally as well. Like we're a little bit out there. We're a little bit different. You know, yeah. We're set aside from the world. We're so far away. We have incredible landscapes and animals and all that kind of stuff. So we do have that interest, you know, in us. But it's funny you say that because I remember many years ago, probably 7 or 8 years ago, my local bookseller knew me because I was the Paris guy, because every time I walked in, I wanted this, you know, what books are set in Paris? Yeah. Because, you know, I was a little bit obsessed back then, in the lead up to a couple of international, European trips. And so I kind of wanted to get into the vibe of Paris and I kept going in and asking about it. And so I became the Paris guy.
The Paris. Oh, that's funny. Yeah. And it's a lovely way to get to know a place. Like when I was at uni, I went and studied in Montreal in Canada, and I read a lot of Margaret Atwood leading into that because I just enjoyed her writing. And then we studied Canadian literature while I was there, you know, and I just felt like I got so much more out of the exchange, you know, because I was reading Canadian literature and being taught it and then living in the country. So, yeah. And then my husband does similar things when we travel. Like he always tries to find like a book by a local author and to read. Do you still read about Paris, or you have moved on to a different city?
No, I unfortunately don't really, you know, pick my books that I read anymore. You know, it's always with a critic hat on or an agent hat on. But you know, I do love Paris. I do love Europe. So if there's books set there, chances are I'm going to be interested for sure. Yeah.
So, Samuel, you work as a writer, a literary critic, a literary award judge, and an agent. So how did you get to where you are, and what was your pathway into the publishing industry?
God, that sounded tiring just listening to it. Have I done all those things?
They're all quite different.
I'm touching on each part of the industry there, I think. No, it's a long story. I loved reading and writing growing up as a kid. My dad really instilled that in me. I used to go with him to the State Library of Queensland to do research topics because he was a writer himself. He self-published a couple of books and they're still in some libraries in awesome. Around Brisbane, which is really exciting. I had that in me from the very beginning. I took the sensible decision out of high school, and that was to become a teacher. Mum and dad were both self-employed. So I think my mum's influence there was, permanent job, steady, you've got your income, you get your sick leave, you've got your holidays, and it sounded very appealing. And so I did it, and I'm very grateful for it because I had some wonderful opportunities. I became a principal of a school and a deputy principal and heads of department. And, I achieved a lot in that.
Primary school or high school, was it?
High school. But the principalship was actually in a primary school, and I would never go back now.
Said you're taking the safe option, but I don't know, a high school teacher doesn't sound particularly safe.
Yeah, that's my 17-year-old brain in action there. I went through years of teaching, and during that time, I never lost that passion for writing and for this industry. And so I did a master's of writing on the side of teaching, and just kept building my profile, I guess, in a sense, and my skill set. I did courses through the Australian Writer Centre and all that kind of stuff, and just kept building that knowledge bank. I was also teaching, high school English literature, that kind of thing. So, I was always engaged in that world. Then I finished my master's of writing. I got into a PhD. I started the PhD with Monash Uni. And after about a year, I had a really frank conversation with my lecturer, who I'm actually his agent now. So that's a cool full circle moment. Mm. Yeah. He said, honestly, you seem so much more passionate about the writing projects and the creative work more than the academic research. So have you considered, a job in the industry? And so I started thinking about that, and I decided at that point I would drop the PhD and I would sort of pursue that.
Was the PhD in? Well, what was it going
to
be?
It was in literature or creative writing, but I did actually 20,000 words of a novel. And it was in conspiracy literature and conspiracy theory in literature. So it was looking at all kinds of different books and works, like Heather Rose, a beautiful book that she wrote set in Tasmania and had a bit of that conspiracy components to it. The Dan Browns, sort of stuff.
That's who I thought of straight away.
And I wrote 20,000 words of my own novel that is set in Canberra. Again, it's a sort of a conspiracy theory based novel, but it was super interesting doing it. But I just loved the writing part of it. And I love editing, and I had a great opportunity there to edit the Monash University publishing Verge Literary Journal, and worked with Carmel Bird and a whole bunch of different authors. And it was just a really rich experience. And I think that tipped me over the edge. I was like, that's it. I want to work in the industry. And I live in Queensland, and so I'm not set in Sydney or Melbourne. So it's a bit tough to work in publishing if you're not in those main cities. But I thought, what can I do remotely? And so I started looking at agenting, because you can read manuscripts anywhere and you can make phone calls anywhere. You can respond to emails anywhere. So, I reached out to Benithan, who's the director of Zeitgeist, and the rest is history. So,
wow. I like how you've gone on, and it's like the path just kind of emerged in front of you.
That's how it kind of sounds. And I feel a little bit, privileged at times, I know, even to the critic side of things, I started writing for Rowena Morecambe, who's the editor-in-chief at Good Reading Magazine. And she gave me a shot at writing criticism for the magazine. And then after a couple of years of doing that, I got a DM from Caroline Overington, who's the literary editor of The Australian. And, you know, she's an author in her own right as well. And she said she loved what I was writing and would I be interested in writing for her? And, you know, so like it certainly feels like, you know, I'm a very privileged person and I acknowledge that. But I did, you know, many, many years of hard work building up my profile, but also my skill set. And it just all kind of started paying off.
Yeah, with writers though, like it's so much hard toil. Essentially, it feels like you're on your own. And then all of a sudden, you know, little cracks in doors start opening. That's interesting because now you largely write feature pieces and like more journalism. So have you put fiction completely to one side? Because I was interested to hear about your 20,000 word novel and whether that's ever going to come, whether we'll ever see that, or is it well and truly in the drawer?
It's a good question. I've often thought about that, but being an agent now, I can probably see. As harsh as it is that I have to admit this to myself, it's probably not a very commercially viable work. It's conspiracy theory set in Canberra. It probably doesn't have a wide readership. So I probably know myself that it may never get published, but, one day I might come back to it. It's a really cool story and, it's in the vein of a Dan Brown, maybe a little bit more, upmarket or literary than Dan Brown, but
does it involve the federal parliament at all? Is there a government?
It does. Yeah, it definitely does because I'm a massive nerd at heart as well.
I think there's something there.
I do enjoy writing, and that's why I've kept going. But yeah, as you said, you know, like I've been lucky that I've now written for like The Guardian and Mamma Mia and Men's Health magazine and a whole raft of publishers. So yeah, I've been very lucky, but I've never wanted to lose that touch of writing. You know, sometimes agents often are editors and are fantastic at what they do, but I really wanted to be a practitioner as well. I really wanted to write in the industry myself.
It's interesting to think, firstly, how many different careers there are in writing and publishing, but then also your foray into teaching and even teaching literature and English, like just how important that is. And it's funny now, I've got two kids in primary school, but, you know, books that had an impact on me when I was their age or young, you know, the books that really shook us in primary school and how important they are in molding ourselves and our view of the world. And like now I'm so keen for like books that were meaningful to me, like I'm like pushing them into my children's hands, like you have to read this, you have to read this, and then thinking about how their world is so different in terms of like the competing technologies and you know, so much more coming at them visually and through their ears, but yet how important you know, that history and culture of reading is, and how we hope that's not lost and how we really have to fight for space and how important that is, I think, for child development too. How are they going to find that space in their world amongst all the other bells and whistles that they've got now?
That's right. It's such a competing world, isn't it, for everyone's attention for everything, you know, marketing to, you know, all the screen time that they're getting from different apps and then TV shows and all sorts of stuff. Everything is just battling for our attention. So yeah, it's a really important question moving forward. And I know I've got a 10-month-old son at home and I already read 2 or 3 books to him per day. I'm like, this kid's gonna read.
Oh, it's such a joy. I still have like all the picture books that my kids read, and even though they've like moved on from them now, like they're so important. Like I'm attached to those books, and even when they want them out of their room, I'm like, no, they're staying in the house. Like, because it represents like all that reading time, and you know, one day maybe we'll have other toddler visitors in our house. So we talked a bit about your work as as a literary agent. What are the advantages? Because in Australia, it's different to some markets where it's almost compulsory. You have to have a literary agent. I think in Australia through unpublished manuscript competitions and submission windows, like it is possible to get published without an agent. But what can you see are the advantages of having an agent in Australia?
Yeah, look, there's there's a whole bunch of different avenues to get published. And, you know, like I'm not the sort of salesperson who's going to sit there and say, you know, you must have an agent and, you know, all that kind of stuff, because the reality is you don't have to have an agent. It's definitely handy, and there are a raft of reasons why, but you're absolutely right. There's, we have a lot of manuscript prizes in Australia, unpublished manuscript prizes. I'm a judge on a couple of them. And so they're really fruitful ways to try and get your foot in the door. There's, you know, I know Affirm Press, amongst many others, open submissions quite regularly to Australian authors. But, you know, there's a whole raft of different reasons why an agent can be really, really handy. Yeah, look, an agent is your translator, your negotiator, your advocate through the whole process. They know contracts inside out. They know which edit, what editors are hungry for what kind of book, you know, who to target. Even in these publishing houses, particularly the biggest ones, there are a number of acquiring publishers and commissioning editors. So knowing who to target, you know, that kind of information is really critical. And the big thing, one of the big things is that you can take the manuscript to the exact right person and basically bypass their entire slush pile. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when these publishing houses do open up their submissions, even that is tricky. Like we at Zeitgeist, we open our submissions. We're open at the moment, and I can just tell you the hundreds of manuscripts that come through into, you know, we call it a bit of a slush pile at times, because there's just so many. It's inundated. It is absolutely inundated sometimes, and things get missed, and you're in competition with so many different people. Whereas with an agent, you know, we pick up the phone, we're talking to any of the publishers in Australia, we've got their direct lines, we basically having an agent puts you to the top of that slush pile list, you know.
Because even just hearing about that, like just the amount of work, like so you open submissions and you've got several hundred like submissions, like just the amount of work, like that's a huge amount of work to sit and give each one a little bit of time to decide, like yeah, it's like drinking from a fire hydrant.
It is. And it's a really sad reality, because sometimes these books can be missed. These wonderful manuscripts can be missed. You know, but beyond the logistics, I guess as well, there's a couple of other things that, you know, agents do. It's a big part for me, and what I continue to hear from authors is my knowledge of the industry. You know, like there are very few writers who are full-time writers, and they all have day jobs. And so when they start to navigate this very, very complex world of publishing, which can feel a little bit smoke and mirrors at times, you know, you've got someone there to hold your hand through the process and to tell you whether this is normal and what to expect at different parts of the process. So, you know, like that's one of those really major parts of how an agent can help you. And I think another one of the biggest advantages is protection. You know, writers should be able to focus on the creative work. An agent can ensure that you're treated fairly, that you're paid properly, that you're positioned strategically, because, you know, we want authors to focus on their creative work, their fun part, which is the writing.
We're not great business people. Writers in general are not hard-headed people in general.
some most certainly are, but you know,
sensitive literary writers are not. it's interesting with my book. So I got my publishing deal through the Australian Society of Authors Literary Speed Dating. Yep. But, you know, I'd already, you know, it was like 2 years on query. I'd already, you know, entered it in things and submission windows. And I think it was my second round of the speed datings. And so I kind of got the publishing offer and an offer of representation kind of like simultaneously. So it was a weird situation. So that's why I asked this question, because, you know, at the time I was asking that question of myself. And so I was lucky enough to sign with the wonderful Jane Novak. But what I felt was, yeah, exactly what you said. Like I felt completely naive to the industry and probably would have, you know, taken anything that was offered because I was so desperate to get the book out. To be honest, you know, I'd walked this long, long road and had, you know, not had any luck to date. And so, yeah, so then she came in to negotiate the contract, contracting deal. But then, as you said, she, what I liked was she had this whole, she knew what the normal range was. So for everything, because I was like, you know, then you go on and you have to do your in-house editing and, you know, timelines get extended. But, you know, she always just had this very level-headed, oh, this is all completely normal. This happens all the time, you know. And so she had all that experience. And the other nice thing is, you know, after you go through the whirlwind of publishing and, you know, you get your few months of promotion, like, you know, your relationship with the publisher, you know, you get all this attention then and then it sort of like goes into a quiet mode because then they have new releases coming out. But the relationship with your agent is ongoing and, you know, they're for you at the literary festivals. And we've had some nice interactions where I've helped her launch books of other authors of hers, you know. And so that it's really nice to feel like even when you haven't got a new book coming out that year, that you're still part of the, you know, the environment and the ecosystem of publishing, you know, because of those relationships.
For sure. Mm. And you know, that is one of the keys as well, is that, you know, they think long term. You know, there's authors that have different publishers over their career. But the one thing that does remain is, you know, your agent.
So since you started writing book reviews and literary critique, what trends have you noticed in Australian publishing? What do you think? What do you think's hot right now?
Oh, that's always the key question, isn't it? It's yeah. Look, it's a good question because we often get this question a lot because we see all the works and the different genres and things like that that are coming through in our slush piles, in our submissions list. But we're also often talking to publishers and other agents, you know, asking what they're looking for. And it's a tricky one because some books, you know, once they're acquired, they take 2 years or 18 months through the publication process. So we're all kind of looking at what is going to be selling, you know, at the moment in 2027, even sometimes 2028. Mm. So it is a tricky one. But right now, sort of how I see the industry, I guess, is, you know, the areas or the trends, I guess, that I've noticed, is that we're starting to see a lot more of the genre fluid fiction, you know, books that sit between literary and commercial. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of, you know, combating these or refusing these neat labels, which I kind of love. The Kate Mildenhall's, you know, her recent book, which is a literary thriller, The Hiding Place. I read that last month and it was just superb. And I loved it. And it took that literary or upmarket kind of, tone and style and I guess melded it with this thriller, really commercial kind of concept. And so that worked really, really well. And so I'm seeing a little bit more of that. I am also seeing more of the contemporary Australian stories with a really strong sense of place, you know, whether it's rural, regional, coastal, suburban, you know, those are, you know, continuing to surge. Anna Johnson, I'm not sure if you know her, but her book, The Borrowed Life of Frederick Fyfe is an absolute gorgeous book. And it is that contemporary Australian story, has a really wonderful sense of place and truly Australian characters. And one of my authors actually, who has her debut coming out in March, Lisa Mull, she has written this gorgeous book that is, you know, domestic suburban set around a primary school, gossiping mothers and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, not everything, I guess, has to be thriller crime. You know, we're seeing these beautiful contemporary Australian stories come through and be really successful and very commercial. Of course,
it's interesting about the genre fluid, because when you're pitching, everyone wants to know, well, what kind of book have you written? So that seems quite risky from a writer's point of view. But sometimes when you write, like often writers, like they put the labels on it when it goes out to market, but when they're sitting in their room typing, they're not thinking so much. Well, I'm not thinking so much about it. You know, they just want to write the story, and it makes sense that texts aren't always going to fit neatly into those boxes. But I think a lot of writers would be fearful of bending and those lines. But yeah,
and it is fair. It is a fair point, because publishers do love their comp titles and they want to know where it's positioned on bookshelves in bookstores. And so it is a little bit risky, but it's also really original and unique. And I think you nailed it. You need to write the book that you are interested in writing, that you're just driven to write. And it is, of course, always nice to know, you know, what the trends are and all that kind of stuff. But if you're a contemporary Australian women's writer and you're like, oh, romanticism is on the rise, I'm going to write that, you know, your heart, your passion might not be into it. Your knowledge, your previous readings, you know, have not really been in that area. So, you know,
I've heard that's a growing genre. Like, was it romanticism, a melding of romance and fantasy?
Over the last 3 years, I would have said absolutely it's the biggest rising genre. But, you know, some conversations I've been having of late seems to think maybe it's on the downward trend. And a lot of Australian readers especially tap into the American writers in this area, you know, the Fourth Wing and that kind of stuff. So we don't have a whole heap of homegrown authors. I actually represent one, which is fantastic. And she's got her second book coming out next month. Her name's Olivia O'Flynn. But yeah, it's an interesting one. And it's even spilled into teens and like middle grade. I sold a trilogy recently, which, you know, is coming out soon, and it went to Penguin in the end, but it was kind of pitched as the Fourth Wing, but for teens.
Yeah.
Right. So it doesn't have all the hectic scenes in it as the Fourth Wing does, but it is that kind of romance for that age group mixed in with the fantasy stuff, and so it is kind of now spilling over into different demographics as well.
I feel like that middle grade, young adult, that's market's getting a lot bigger. Like, there's a lot more complicated books and series feeding into that, which because it's kind of a niche area. When I was pitching my book, it's funny because I thought it was just like, it's either commercial or it's literary. But the more I spoke to agents and publishers, you know, there were all these in between. Like, I remember there was book club fiction or smart women's fiction. Like, there were like shades of gray in between commercial and literary, because it's sometimes hard to characterize. And like, I love Sally Rooney, and obviously she's a very literary author. But, you know, a book like Normal People, you can't argue that's not. You know, like, I know it might not sit neatly in commercial, but it's a huge commercial success. defied all that. So you judged in 2024, you judged the inaugural Australian Fiction Prize. How was that experience? And I'm just so fascinated how difficult it was to determine a winner, because I imagine, how do you compare texts that might be so different?
I know it is. It was the most rewarding experience of my career. It was definitely one of the highlights of my career. And I was thankful that I got to do it again this year. So, you know, 2 years that the Australian Fiction Prize has been running, and I've been a judge on both, which I'm very excited about and very proud of. And I've actually just accepted being a judge for the Dorothy Hewitt Award 2026 as well, which is very exciting. But it is incredibly tough. Both years, I can hang my hat on the fact that both years I've actually called the winner from very early on. Even this year, there were six judges, and five of them thought other books might end up being the winner. This was before our judges meeting and before we, had it out for hours on end. But both years I picked the winner from the get-go.
And how long is the list that you have to read? Because obviously it must be shortened somewhat before they give you the books. Yeah. But how many books around do you need to read?
Yeah. So the Australian Fiction Prize itself, all the prizes are a little bit different, but the Australian Fiction Prize itself, they longlist in-house and then they send those out to the judges for, you know, the finalists and the eventual winner. So yeah, it's a lot of reading, but it's also really enjoyable. You know, you feel like you're, you know, on the cutting edge of the industry in that moment, because you're really having a say on, you know, a fairly major prize in the Australian landscape. So
like
it is
gold panning. Looking for gold. And then do you go to the meeting? So say everyone's read the books and then you go to meet with the other judges, and do you kind of campaign, or do you kind of like you have to stand up and say which books you think should win, or will you just sort of have point out?
Yeah, no, it doesn't. I'd love to do that. I like the visual and the imagery of standing up and really, you know, boasting
who
should win. Yeah, that's right. But we do it very diplomatically and democratically. We go through each book. We talk through the pros and not necessarily the cons, but areas that I think if a publisher got their hands into it, or an editor, you know, the things that they might work on. Because these are unpublished manuscripts. These are early drafts in a lot of senses. So we need to keep in mind, and we always remind each other of this, that it's about the potential for the book. And of course it needs to have a certain level of good writing and all that in there. But you know, we're kind of overlooking the more minor structural or character, you know, flaws, I guess. And looking at it for what it can be once an editor can sink their teeth into.
Because I guess what's easy to fix, what's easier to fix, and then what's harder.
Exactly.
I guess what sort of captures people's imaginations, or what the text stands for.
Yeah, spot on. Yeah, and a lot of that stuff, you know, we talk through those, and you're just like, yep, that's an easy fix. That will happen in no time. Or it could be a different book where you're just like, this is actually a really major issue and it's going to be really hard to overcome this. The writing's good, you know, other aspects are there. But you know, there might just be something there that puts a bit of a block on it. And we, you know, we have to talk that out, and we have to reach a consensus in the end, about a winner, which is exciting and also, you know, sad for the people that didn't, you know, get that end result. But
shortlisted or longlisted for a major award, and usually there's judges' comments which go back to the which she can convey their strength.
Yeah.
All right, we're nearly out of time. A couple more questions, if we don't get kicked out. So, if new and emerging writers are listening and interested in signing with an agent, what are a couple of things you suggest that they should and shouldn't do?
Ooh. Okay. Let's start with they should do. You should definitely polish your manuscript before you query. So not during, you know, don't feel like you need to rush it out and just get it into people's hands, and then you're tinkering behind the scenes while you wait for responses. I was talking to a publisher at HarperCollins the other day that said, you know, you only get a first shot at making a first impression. And there's so many books out there that, you know, if there's some major structural flaws or you know, big plot holes or something like that, it, you know, it could be enough to just turn the publishers or agents away from the get-go. So you need to make sure, like, it. And I, one of my authors, Brooke Crawford, was on a podcast I was listening to earlier today. And you know, she gave me a little shout out, so I'll give her a little shout out. Mm-hmm. But you know, she was talking about how at some point you do just have to take the plunge. And of course we could tinker with books for years and years and years, but you know, if you'll get to a point, I think, where you're like, this is in pretty good shape. And I think I'm ready to send this out to people. I feel confident, you know, I've had some beta readers, I've edited, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I think one of those major ones is do make sure that you polish your manuscript.
So be prepared. Be well prepared, but be brave as well.
Yeah, I like that. And do your research. So another one is know which agents or publishers you're targeting. So I get so many books come through, you know, picture books and things like that. And I'm just, that's just not my area. And it's pretty clear on our websites, you know, you'll often go to each agent's website and it's on there, and same as publishers. So really do your research, because, you know, that's an easy way to get some people offside in the industry, is, you know, that, we don't have a lot of time, and so, people can get a bit frustrated by that. But it's also just for the author, it's a quick no then. From the agent, that it's like, oh, delete, and you've just wasted all that valuable time.
Anything they shouldn't do, anything.
Yeah, plenty of things. You know, but to try and be succinct, I guess don't ever send that first draft. As I said, you know, make sure it's polished. And, you know, we were just sort of touching on this before, but don't frame your book as like it's unlike anything you've ever seen. Because we, you know, we do need to know where it kind of sits. And as I said before, we're starting to see this kind of molding of different genres together. But, you know, that's not to say that people haven't done that before. You know, if you're writing a literary thriller, you know, you might comp title Kate Mildenhall. Mm. And if you're writing a romanticy, you know, like, you know, it, knowing where to frame your book is so critical. So, yeah, don't go in and say there has been nothing written like this ever. Yeah. You know,
but also, like, agents don't want a book that's from outer space, right? Like, that's when you say there's never been anything. It's like, it's not like an object of, you know, space artifacts. But, and also, you want to, well, I felt like you want to stand in the history of writing. Like, you want to stand alongside your other writers, like, you're going to have contemporaries, or stand in that line of Australian fiction and writing, or global fiction, right? You know, that's an amazing place to stand, but you want to be a part of it. You don't want to be something like out of this solar system.
That's exactly right. Yeah, spot on. Yeah. Mm.
All right. We've made it to the end. So you mentioned before, I can't imagine not picking what I read. I can't, because I'm not a professional editor. I'm a writer, and I can indulge myself. But what are you reading now? Is it that you can tell us about? Or what is another book you've read recently that you would recommend to listeners? So you have to give us something that's probably published so that they can find it.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, that's interesting, because I'm reading Tim Ahliff's Dark Desert Road at the moment for January, because that doesn't come out until January.
Okay. Oh, well, by the time this is out, it'll be out, so we can put that in.
Yeah,
notes.
Beautiful. Yeah. So that's Dark Desert Rose Road, and it's fantastic. Really good. He's a great writer. I really enjoy his writing. It's sort of in that Candace Fox kind of realm of writing.
Is it? Is it dystopian, futuristic, or no? Is it contemporary or historical?
Well, it's like it's set with a fugitive sister, a dangerous father. Like, it, you know, that's how it's sort of set up. It's so it's very, very enjoyable so far from what I've read. And I'll have my full review in the Weekly Australian in January, so you can check that out.
Yeah.
I mentioned Kate Mildenhall's the Hidden Place earlier on, that came out last month. And it was in my, you know, my top 10 books. And I actually said, in a little social media post for The Australian, it was my pick, of all the books So, like, I really did get into it. I think it's, really, you know, really well written, very, very enjoyable. But I also, secretly, and I didn't write about this one, it didn't end up making my cut, just for, you know, various reasons when I'm putting together my lists for you know, the notable books and things like that. But Brian Brown, he's a sneaky good writer. You know, everyone would know him from being a movie star, basically, but I reviewed his previous book for the Weekend Australian in a long form review you know, a year or two ago. But his new book, The Hidden, is, he's sneaky good writer, and I really enjoy his work. So that might be
what is it? Is it fiction
as well?
Is that fiction?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize he wrote it.
Yes, well, he had a book of short stories that came out a few years ago, and it did really well. And then he did a full novel, and that's the one I reviewed, and now he's got The Hidden that's come out.
Is it very funny? I can imagine him having this wicked dry sense of humour.
Literally, I just picture his voice the entire time. Like, it's, he's very distinctive storytelling. Yeah. Like, he's very uniquely Brian Brown.
Excellent.
But anyone who's a fan of Brian's, you know, movie work will absolutely sort of love his writing. So,
great. Yeah. Oh, well, there you go. That'll be a podcast exclusive. We can put them all in the notes. Well, Samuel, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. There's so much in our discussion that I think other people will find interesting and helpful as well. Good luck with the 10 books that you're reading.
Yeah.
And we look forward to reading your column in the Australian of your notable
thank you.
Books. Yeah.
And it's been a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me on. It's always good to try and, you know, shed some light on this industry. It doesn't come that easily sometimes, all this knowledge. So I'm more than happy to jump on and share whenever I can.
Yeah, it's great to peek through the smoke and mirrors on occasion.
Yeah.
All right.
That's right.
Have a great day. Thank you.